Welcome to the latest episode of Public Power Now. I'm Paul Ciampoli, APPA's News Director. Our guest on this episode is Dan Beans, Electric Utility Director for the Public Power Community of Roseville, California. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Sure thing. So Dan, wanted to start a conversation by talking about the ongoing supply chain challenges facing the electric utility sector, which seems like a pretty intractable problem at this point facing the sector. So wanted to know if you could talk about or just provide an overview of supply chain challenges facing Roseville's utility and also detail strategies that the utilities implemented to address those challenges.
Well, thanks, Paul. So yeah, let me start with just a broad overview of what's happening. So in a nutshell, distribution transformers and other critical grid equipment lead times and costs are 200 to 500% longer and more expensive, including, transformers, small and large, cable, wire, meters, switchgear, poles, even line trucks. Meanwhile, the federal government and California are doing everything they can to make it worse. DOE is introducing new efficiency standards in the middle of a crisis, California mandating aggressive electrification and zero emission line trucks that don't exist. Both entities creating chaos in the market, making it unlikely manufacturers will invest in production lines to help meet the new demand. I spent over a year participating on a national tiger team under the ESCC, and APPA is a big part of that. I've been to DC several times over the year and a half. I've lobbied with the National Association of Home Builders, talked with the Department of Energy, NERC, FERC, congressional members and staff. In a nutshell, we've done a ton of different things, strategies to try to raise awareness of this issue, try to get some relief and all that. So back to Roseville, when I started at Roseville as the director CEO just about 2 years ago, that community was developing and building approximately 1,800 new homes each year. And up until that point, we would just install the underground infrastructure. We had all the new neighborhoods, ready to go. We had poles and light, it's all underground. So the light poles and transformers and cable, everything was installed. The developers come behind us and they could build homes as fast as they wanted. And then very shortly after I started at Roseville, so within like a month or so, we started getting calls from our distributor for transformers saying that the last several orders that we had weren't going to be delivered. And so we immediately went and looked at what we had already installed in the field and verified our stock inventory at the yard. And fortunately, because of past practice, we actually had enough transformers already in the field to build over 1,500 homes. So that gave us almost a year of carryover time. At that point, we also set aside, we looked at our typical attrition rate, just normal system restoration and failures. And so we set aside enough transformers for about 3 years worth based on the assumption we didn't know when we would get another transformer. It could be 1 year, could be 3 years. Eventually, our stock dwindled, and we got to the point where we had to save everything we had left for current existing customers. And that happened in August of this year, or last year. So we came to that point where we were writing a letter to the developers to meet with them and let them know that we would not be able to support any more house building until we got more transformers. Fortunately, as that was about to happen, we started getting a trickle of transformers from our domestic manufacturer. But early on, when we first recognized this was becoming an issue and there was no relief domestically, our transformer spec only allowed us to buy domestic transformers, which it was a good policy, and there was always never an issue with that. Well, we went to council a couple of years ago and asked them if we could sole source some transformers from South Korea. And so we did that, and they were promised to us to be delivered within 6 months. So we thought, okay, this could be a good short-term solution. So we ordered those transformers, only to find out that within a short time after we did that, a local investor-owned utility ordered 40,000 transformers. And so our order of 50 really didn't seem to place any emphasis. So we didn't get those in 6 months. In fact, we didn't get them till just last month. So that was almost over a year and a half. So that is one thing we've done. We've expanded our, where we will buy transformers, although I'm not a fan. I think that the grid is too critical and that we should domestically be able to support it.
So a couple of quick follow-up questions that come to mind. I mean, I guess first, it strikes me that crystallize in terms of crystallizing the serious nature of these transformer shortages is the impact on housing construction. Is that, do you think that that's resonating with decision makers in terms of kind of really making it clear that this is a really significant problem that needs to be solved?
I believe it definitely has helped. In fact, some of the lobbying I've done, when I went with the home builders, that's when I connected them up with APPA. And since then, they've done several joint letters to both DOE and also congressional staff. And so I believe that is part of it. I actually developed a flyer that I would take to DC because I wasn't convinced that DOE or any of them out there knew actually how the grid worked and what transformers were and like how they fit into the system. So I created a little diagram that showed, here's a transformer, here's your electric car, here's your solar, here's your house or your business. And then on the inside, it said, without these, you can't do any of these things. And so depending on what side of the aisle you are, you know, if you wanted to meet your climate goals, you can't do it without transformers. If you want to have economic development and solve housing crisis, you can't do that without transformers. So it really is a nonpartisan issue. So I think, you know, we definitely had some success by having many facets of this issue and all the things that it affects, because it affects everything, as you know.
Yeah. And the second question I had was, you know, you mentioned South Korea and ordering transformers from that country. I mean, it sounds to me that global markets, based on your experience with South Korea, at least, is not a sustainable solution to meeting these challenges.
Exactly. I do not believe it is. I mean, one of the problems we're having with transformers is steel. And there's only one remaining steel factory in the United States that makes the grain-oriented electrical steel needed for transformers. That same factory would also be the one that would make the non-oriented electrical steel for electric vehicle motors, which are becoming more popular and higher demand. So having a lack of domestic ability to build the fundamental building blocks of your grid, to me, is entirely unacceptable.
And I guess none of us have a crystal ball, but is it as of today, I guess it's really hard to say when these transformer shortages will kind of resolve in terms of getting greater access to them.
Well, recently, Roseville has had some of its deliveries from its domestic, and we finally did get the ones from Korea. We have got those in, but so there is a short respite. But if you do the math and you look at the big picture, this is far from over. I was in a state hearing, and I made the comment that you know, transformers aren't toilet paper. This isn't going to be resolved very quickly. Costco's not going to start stocking transformers for us. So this is a bigger issue. It takes a long time to set tariffs, to build factories, to build a workforce, to get the necessary raw materials, all of it. It's a complex process, and it takes time. And the more I work in DC and lobby, the less hope I have that there's any kind of sense of urgency coming from that side.
Yeah, I think you really kind of made it a perfect kind of summation of the challenges. It goes way beyond, okay, we need five more transformers. There's so many variables that are involved in getting that across the finish line.
Right. And Paul, the scary part is the government's known about this. I mean, this isn't a COVID thing. There's studies that I used when I was on the Tiger team to write a paper over 10, 12 years old that talk about this. In 2018, also, the Department of Commerce did a Section 232 study and said, hey, this is a national crisis. This is a national security issue. This is a crisis to not have domestic steel, you know, for transformers, for grid components, for military. And so they've identified this. And DOE has some studies that they've identified. I mean, there is a ton of federal papers that are credible, that have facts that talk about how bad this is and what a bad situation this is. And yet there's no action coming out to address it that's meaningful.
Thanks for this part of the conversation. So wanted to switch gears in terms of topics and talk about rates, and specifically wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about the ways in which Roseville's utility is working to keep rates affordable for its customers.
Thank you, Paul. So I'll give just a quick bullet list of what we're doing, and then I'll dive into some details. So we do have regular and planned investments in our infrastructure, including our local power generation. We're always optimizing and hedging our energy resources portfolio to shield our customers from volatile energy and gas markets. And we do a lot of advocating for sanity and incrementalism at the state and federal governments. But there are several issues that are putting cost pressures on us. And you can look at the price of natural gas and then the correlating electricity prices in California and probably elsewhere in the country. When Russia invaded Ukraine and started playing with the gas pipeline to Europe, and then America started increasing its exports to Europe to help them out, creating more demand for us and cost pressures, while the Biden administration is restricting getting that natural gas out of our country, which we have plenty of. So we have this artificially created situation where our fuel prices are crazy, like 200-300% higher for natural gas. We were paying like $3 gas, now we're $6 to $9, depending on the season and what's happening. And so, yeah, that's creating a huge impact on our budget. Our hedging program helps, but it doesn't absorb all of it. So having our own gas plant, natural gas plant, to be able to go with the market and sell into the market has been helpful. Another thing that's been going up in general is labor. And so we've been very diligent about that since I've came to Roseville. If a position leaves, we don't just immediately hire. We look at it, evaluate it. We've done some reorganizations, optimizing. We want to make sure, because we're public, we're nonprofit, we have to make sure every role we have is needed and is providing value and service to the public. So we do keep an eye on that. Obviously, we're talking about commodity prices in general. Transformers have gone up, but everything has gone up and everybody has seen that. It's not just at the grocery store, it's hitting utilities. Everything we buy, I mean, the transformer costs are incredible. But up until this point, the costs were not the issue. It's just getting them. Like, it's more important to have a transformer than whether or not you had to pay, $15,000 more for it.
So, Dan, as you know, California has aggressive state mandates that apply to utilities in the state. So against that backdrop, wanted to give you the opportunity to offer additional details about mandates that Roseville's utility is facing in California, and also the ways in which utility is working to meet those mandates.
Well, thank you, Paul. This is definitely an aggressive state to work in. So just at a very high level, California excels at creating a challenging business environment, which it in turn creates affordability issues for residents. California not only tells us what our emissions have to be in the coming years, they also change the target frequently, always making it more aggressive. Then they tell us how we are to meet the mandates and then how we are not allowed to meet the mandates. For example, it's all about emissions, right? Well, then why doesn't California allow large hydro plants to count as renewable energy? These are usually federal projects that are paid for by customers and emit no emissions. California screams affordability from the rooftops, all the while creating this environment where business struggle. Then California regulators tell us what tools to use to build, to maintain, and operate the grid, even zero-emission mine trucks. In short, California treats the electric grid and supporting gas infrastructure like a laboratory. They expect reliability and affordability, yet they base their policies on academics and theories. Never mind the not-for-profit grid operators, public power, our communicating issue. Barely a year ago, the governor of California used the Amber Alert system to get people to turn their thermostats up to avoid rolling blackouts in California. Meanwhile, they are shutting down perfectly good natural gas plants. So yes, California has several mandates. In fact, we're just finishing up a strategic plan, and I polled our employees and asked them from their perspective in their roles, what the biggest threat to our utility and our businesses and our customers. And the overwhelming answer was energy policy or government mandates. Mm-hmm. And that actually lines up with the NERC report that came out in August. And it says the number one issue that reliability of the grid is energy policy. And it's not just reliability, it's the affordability, which is interesting, California especially, but also the federal government, they tap and say affordability, equity, all these nice words that sound really great. And then they implement their policies, which are mutually exclusive. I was at a conference recently, and one of the slides that one of the presenters pulled up showed that by 2025, your overall energy costs would be lower than today. Well, the assumption of that is you'd be driving an electric vehicle, you would not be using gasoline or gas in your home, and your electricity would be off the charts compared to now. And the problem is, with everything else assuming zero and then electricity super high, what about between now and then, the 20 years in between? How is that going to work? And so that's the missing piece, is the 20 years today, from now to for the next 20 years. How do we get through this transition in the way that they are approaching it, which I believe is technically not workable and humanly not reasonable.
And just a quick follow-up. So the strategic plan, is that separate from what people would refer to as an integrated resource plan?
Yes, it's an additional plan. So our integrated resource plan is something we do by California mandate, but we do it anyway. But
right.
California wants to make sure we don't forget.
Right.
And so then, yeah, we have a strategic plan. It's a little more high level, but it includes, you know, those kind of things, everything from labor to resources. And then, you know, what kind of issues do we have? Are we looking forward to the next several years? In fact, we targeted our strategic plan, even though we'll modify it in the intervening years, but we targeted 2035 because in California, that's when they're planning on not allowing you to buy a new internal combustion engine, which I don't think will actually happen. I think things are going to change eventually, but.
Right. And just out of curiosity, when is there a timeline for when the strategic plan is expected to be completed?
Yeah, we're going to have that actually out in March is
okay.
The plan. Yeah. So it's coming up here quick.
Okay.
So the other thing that California does with their mandates and their rules is they're always trying to get their nose under our public power tent. And they're always out wanting to try to regulate us more. And then what's ironic about that is they already regulate the utilities that serve a majority of Californians' electricity. Their prices are double our prices. Their reliability is 1/10 our reliability. They've got years and years of track record. And all you have to do is look at it and go, wait, what? You want to regulate our utilities? Well, we've been doing it for 110 years better than you. I don't think that's necessary or in the interest of our customers.
Dan, just to wrap up our conversation today, wanted to kind of step back and give you the opportunity to provide your overall thoughts about the energy industry's transition to things like renewable energy, electric vehicles, and energy storage, among other things, and then kind of maybe circle back to how Roseville's utility has positioned itself to succeed as the energy transition continues to advance.
All right. Thank you, Paul. I'm going to start with that last portion first. So Roseville, one of the things that the city of Roseville has done in the utility as well is they really have that focus on employees, which really helps it set itself up for success. Roseville has a mantra of being, they want to be the employer of choice. And that whole culture and that whole thought process goes through all the departments, including electric. The city recognizes, you know, the council and the city manager and all, everyone else. They recognize the superior service that comes with qualified, engaged, and enthusiastic staff. And wherever you live, whether you're in California or any kind of state, you can't serve your community without good people. And that's what public power is all about. And I think it's one of the key reasons why state-regulated investor-owned utilities is so dismal in their performance compared to public power. You don't have the same, there's not the same accountability. When the customers call, we answer the phone, we take the media questions. We have regular meetings like twice a month that are actually accessible geographically because we're all, the council, which is our commission, is they all live in the city that we serve. So it's just, public power just is a superior model and definitely worth protecting. Just an example, our current customers compared to the neighboring investor-owned utilities each year save $230 million. That is a crazy amount. As I mentioned, our rates are half. One of the most important things we do, back to the energy transition, one of the most important things we do as an electric utility is to frequently engage all levels of government with facts and operational insight. The problem is whether you're the state regulators and legislators or federal, these people, they're smart, they want to do a good job, but they don't do what we do and they don't understand it. And so it's incumbent on us to be there often because they have a lot of staff changeover and to constantly communicate and educate. And so one of the worst things we can do is to be silent. So, and just don't just go along with their plan, because I want to wrap up with a kind of a closing statement of what I think of their plan, but public power, like we need to be always talking. We need to always be visible. I would strongly encourage everyone to go to the APA Ledge Rally in DC in February. That's a great place and time to gather and talk and educate. So we definitely, you know, that's part of the job is to be vocal. But in general, with this whole transition, trying to go to this different economy using materials that we won't dig out of our own ground or don't have in our own ground, such as the things needed for electric vehicles and batteries. To me, it's not a wise course. The Director of National Intelligence publishes a report every year, the annual threat assessment. And I read last year's came out in February, so I expect a new one will be coming out soon. And that in that report, he talks about how China is purposely, their goal is to control our supply chains so they can manipulate Western policy. It also talks about how China, by 2025, if they haven't already, will control 65% of the world's lithium-ion battery market. These are things that we are building our economy on, a battery-operated wind and solar grid that technically doesn't work, that we don't have the ability to maintain, replace, build in the first place without other nations who are not always friendly. And I know I hear from California. California has got a very interesting attitude. And my message is, if California and America wants to lead the world, then my advice is to keep the experimentation at the national labs and then test it with willing customers, not on everybody. And then when you have your stuff figured out, then you can start to put it out in the field. But making customers unwilling participants in a scheme that has no defined success or achievable goal will eventually cause them to lose trust. So the speed and the way that California and the federal government's trying to, you know, change the grid, change this new economy, is foolhardy. It's not planned out. It's not going to work. And we need to make sure we're continuing to make sure they know that we know that it's not going to work. Yeah, I hate to always sound negative about this, but if we just go to DC and say, hey, yeah, everything's great. Oh, yeah, those are great goals. Goals are great. But you're talking about people's lives. You're talking about businesses. You're talking about the well-being and the security of our country. You can't be trivial about that. This isn't a place to experiment. The grid is not a laboratory. Americans are not venture capitalists. Some rationalization, some rational thoughts and better choices need to start to be made.
Well, I guess so. Thanks, Dan. So, I mean, I guess just you know, you talked about, I mean, in terms of California, is there anything that maybe there's a positive aspect in terms of what California is doing as it relates to the energy sector?
Well, California geographically has a lot of cool diversity, mountains and stuff. I love that about California. California politics, leading the way, being inspirational, I guess that's okay. But the way they do it is inappropriate. And
there's a concern about kind of the, you know, the rubber, in terms of the rubber hitting the road and impacts on communities.
Yeah, they want it to be affordable, and yet they're giving us tasks and making it so we can't. Like, small modular reactors someday should be a key part, most likely, of everybody's power supply. But they won't even consider nuclear. Like, they take everything off the table and then say offshore wind and solar and batteries. Well, and then it's going to be interesting when they want to get their offshore wind, because California really is invested in offshore wind for their future. Nobody wants a transmission line to their backyard, which California coastal city or town or whatever, you got to run those lines through. It's a very interesting thing. And it's not the same resource. Honestly, if I was in charge and they said, hey, how would you, you know, you're very salty on this subject and you have very strong opinions, how would you clean this up and make this better? And my solution would be, if you really care about the emissions, then you would, you know, nationally, you would repower all your coal plants with natural gas. You would start pumping that natural gas out as fast as you could. Prices would be super low. You could help Europe. You could boost everybody's economy. You could lower electric rates, make them very, very affordable. Then you could put a tax on that. And for the next 30 years, you could have the best companies in the U.S. competing to figure out what that next generation grid looks like. It'd be affordable. It would be clean. We'd save more emissions than we do now. in California during the crisis in September 2022, we were running diesel generators at wastewater plants to keep the grid from blacking out. Like, this is nonsense. What they're doing doesn't make sense. So we have to keep telling our story.
Okay, Dan. Well, thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us, and we'd love to have you back. Perhaps sometime next year, we could revisit this and other topics.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. And since you mentioned the legislative rally that APPA is holding, I wanted to let our listeners know that additional details on the rally are available on APPA's website, and it's scheduled to take place February 26th through the 28th. Thanks for listening to this episode of Public Power Now, which is produced by Julio Guerrero, graphic and digital designer at APPA. I'm Paul Schimpoli, and we'll be back next week with more from the world of public power.